This is Roger Bowman speaking from the NBC newsroom in New York. This evening, a large part of our program is going to come from Paris. But first, a brief summary of the top news of the moment. The Army will release 2,500 veterans tomorrow in the first discharges under the point rating system. Price Administrator Chester Bowles has promised 1942 retail prices for most reconversion products. Killing frost has hit most of the North Central United States. General Eisenhower is going to head the American part of the Allied Military Control Council in Germany. Russian forces have practically mopped up die-hard Nazi resistance in Czechoslovakia. And B-29 superfortresses have hit Japan again, and the Tokyo radio tells of new Allied air blows on Formosa. Later, I'll give you more details about this news. And now we take you to NBC in Paris for a report by Roy Porter. Go ahead, NBC in Paris.
This is Roy Porter in Paris. This is a fantastic story of a new development in a world war in Europe which is officially over, but with a few pockets left to clean up. The details of this account, which began yesterday in the vicinity of Saint-Nazaire on the Atlantic coast of France and ended late this afternoon, include such amazing incidents as the efforts of a German garrison commander to surrender himself and 27,000 men to one American Air Force captain and one American war correspondent, plus the so-called liberation of six French towns by this same American Air Force captain and the same American war correspondent, and finally, a mock battle staged by French troops to occupy positions from the Germans after they had already been occupied by the Americans. If that doesn't sound fantastic, let me explain in detail. Captain Bill Brucker of the 9th Air Force, whose family lives at 9 Rose Street in East Hartford, Connecticut, and I left Paris yesterday afternoon, headed for Saint-Nazaire in Brittany at the mouth of the Loire River. We knew that surrender terms with the Germans in this Saint-Nazaire pocket had already been arranged, and we wanted to see what the place looked like after 5 years of occupation. We knew that there was an airfield near the resort town of La Baule, and that was booked as our destination. We were a little worried when we got near the field because we knew there'd been a lot of flak around there recently. We saw crowds of people in the streets of the nearby towns, and I innocently remarked to Bill, they must be celebrating the surrender right now. And then we saw crowds of people along the edges of the airfield, and as we came closer, we saw that they were all Germans, and we began to worry a bit. But that was only the first of our worries. We circled again and finally decided to land, and Bill Brucker turned to me and said, "You don't suppose that field is mine, do you?" And then we went straight on in. Everything was all okay. We got out to stretch our legs when we noticed a delegation of Germans coming toward us. Two high-ranking officers followed by a lot of lesser rank and a few ordinary soldiers. And Bill looked at me and I looked at him, and we wondered what it was all about. They stopped, they clicked their heels and saluted. We saluted and waited. That period of waiting probably lasted about 30 seconds, but it certainly was a long 30 seconds. And finally I said in French, "Does anyone speak French?" A German corporal stepped up, and the commanding officer said to him in German for translation, "I am the commanding officer of this garrison. I assume that you have come to accept our surrender." Well, that unexpected announcement was the most surprising thing in a long series of surprises in this war. I couldn't help but turn to Bill and say, "Have we come to accept their surrender, Bill?" And he used an army expression which is very popular among the GIs and which, translated for radio, means, "Well, I'll be doggone if I know." I turned back to the commander and said, "How many men do you have?" And it was this final reply that really staggered us, because the answer came back promptly, 27,000 men, including the Luftwaffe. Well, by this time, it had become apparent that there was something wrong somewhere. We apparently were someplace where we had not been expected and where we had not expected to be. In the ensuing conversation, it turned out that the Germans had been waiting for 3 days for someone to come and get them. That when we landed so nonchalantly, they thought we were the Allied delegation, and they were ready to go through with it. They described how they'd already collected all of their arms, their rifles and pistols and grenades and bombs, everything they had for our inspection, and they were holding themselves for our disposition. Mind you, all this was very official, and we were forced to keep a solemn face. I didn't dare look at Bill, and he turned away from me. But the cold dignity of the Germans never relaxed. Finally, we told him we'd have to get some more information. And we asked them if they could furnish us a car, which they promptly did with a German sailor for a driver, and we took off after much more saluting and bowing. Well, that was only the first of the surprises, because we had not even gotten off the airfield before we ran into a crowd of French people, young, old, and middle-aged, and they were waving and shouting in the middle of the road around a German barricade. I stuck my head out of the window to see what they were saying, and I was never more astonished in my life, because it was this: les premiers, ils sont là, les premiers, ils sont là, which means simply, the first ones, they are there, the first ones, they are there. I couldn't figure it out, and I got out of the car to check a little further, and before I had time to say hardly anything, I was being kissed by girls and old ladies alike, clouted on the back by sturdy Breton farmers, and wrung by the hand by French resistance men wearing tricolored armbands. I looked over at Bill. He was trying to wipe a big gob of lipstick off his cheek. And he turned to me and he said, "Brother, what have you gotten us into?" Well, that was the beginning of a story which kept on mounting all during the afternoon and evening, and which lasted until so late at night that we had to beg off and tell these French people that we were tired and wanted to go to bed. We were taken into a small village where a crowd gathered, where we were loaded with flowers, where the old village priest came out and made a speech, to which I had to reply in French, and where one precious bottle of champagne was broken out. The FFI, the men of the French resistance, formed a guard of honor for us and hastily moved us off to La Baule, one of the well-known Atlantic coast resort towns. There we found crowds running into several thousands, lined up in the streets, and always this cry of les premiers, the first ones. We were taken to the city hall, to the command post of Major Louis Desmarres, who had led all resistance in the Brittany region for 5 years, ever since the town of La Baule had been occupied on June 21st, 1940. And he hastily put on his French uniform of commandant and resumed his real name. That was the first of the big celebrations. There were speeches telling of the people's gratitude of their liberation. There were all kinds of shouts, such as Vive l'Amérique, Vive la France, Vive Roosevelt, Vive Truman, Vive Churchill, and Vive almost anything or anybody, and always ending with the cry, Hooray for peace. These Frenchmen and women had been waiting for 3 days for Allied troops to come in, just as the Germans had been waiting to surrender. And we, an Air Force captain and a war correspondent, turned out to be the first ones to arrive. And always we were asked, when are the troops moving in? And always we had to defer to the French major, who obviously knew a great deal more about it than we did, and he said he didn't know for certain, but he thought it might be tomorrow. I had to make a speech in French to the crowd, and all I could say was that we were happy to be there, that we were happy that their 5 years of occupation had ended. And then I told them about the end of the war in Europe, and the capture of Göring and Kesselring, and they went wild with joy all over again. And that ceremony at La Baule was only the first of six of their kind. Because we were taken out of the German car and rushed into a French car, and with a motorcycle escort and British and French and American flags flying, we visited and performed what they called the liberation of more French towns in the district, which has long been known as one of the toughest resistance centers in all of France. After Escoublac, where the airfield is, and after La Baule, we went to Le Croisic and Poisic and Guérande, and Pornichet. And there was always a crowd. We were kissed time after time. We were presented with huge bouquets of beautiful Breton roses. There were always lots of speeches. There were always songs and cheers. And there was always either champagne or wine, which we had to drink out of pure courtesy. The joy and the emotion exhibited by these people of Brittany, from the women and the girls to the weather-burned old fishermen who made so many secret trips across the channel with Allied airmen and resistance leaders, this joy and emotion was so genuine, it was so real and so full of gratitude, that all the celebration became a solemn duty to us. And we, Bill Brucker and I, felt it deeply ourselves. We found one American prisoner in La Baule in a German hospital. He is Private Merlin L. Anstein, whose wife lives in Beresford, South Dakota. And although he had been badly wounded, he was overjoyed to see us, and to tell us that he had received the first letter from his wife. The story really ended about 9 o'clock this morning when the Americans did arrive in force. And there was another welcoming celebration, and then the French began to arrive. We were the first at the airfield, and our officers and GIs paid very little attention to the Germans. But a few hours later, the French began to arrive in combat formation and wildly waving their guns, and the commandant was finally allowed to surrender to the Germans. Captain Bill Brucker is back in Paris with me tonight, and I want him briefly to confirm what I've just told you. Bill, wasn't that the most unexpected thing you've ever run into?
Well, I have always wondered what it would be like to liberate the French terror. Yesterday, although we didn't know that we were going to do it, we liberated six. I'll never, never forget it. To see men and women weeping and shouting, it was one of the greatest experiences I've had since I've been in Europe.
And Bill, do you feel the way I do about the real sentiment of these people?
I not only feel the same way, I know that it was all absolutely sincere. That our arrival and the arrival of American and French troops was something that those people have been waiting for, waiting anxiously for 5 years of domination under the Nazis. They are happy tonight, and they deserve to be.
Thank you, Captain Brucker of the 9th Air Force, and now this is Roy Porter returning you to the NBC newsroom in New York.
Thank you, Roy Porter. And now in the time remaining, here's the news in greater detail. German war prisoners in the United States have been ordered to see the motion pictures of atrocity victims. This was announced by the War Department today, which stated that the spoken commentary for the films have been translated into German. To impress the brutality of their countrymen on the prisoners' minds, pamphlets of still pictures with German captions showing details of the Nazi mass murders will be distributed to each camp. Also, it's announced that the German prisoners will find canteen shelves bare of cigarettes, beer, candy, and similar items after existing supplies are used up. General Eisenhower will be the American chief of the military government in Germany. The overall council will be composed of the United States, Russia, Britain, and France. General Eich also will be the military commander of the American occupation zone. Eisenhower's chief assistant will be another tough soldier, Lieutenant General Lucius Clay, whom the late President Roosevelt hand-picked for the job. Clay will supervise the entire denazification program and the ruthless suppression of German underground activity. Russian forces have practically wiped out the last of Nazi resistance in Czechoslovakia. The Soviet high command, enraged by Marshal Ferdinand Schirner's violation of Germany's unconditional surrender, threw armored, aerial, and ground troops into the battle. They succeeded in smashing the Germans' attempt to retreat to American lines, where they hoped vainly for refuge. German resistance in Prague has ended, except for occasional sniping by a few die-hard Nazis. In the Pacific, swarms of American superforts roared over the heart of Japan today, blasting industrial cities, oil reserves, a seaplane factory, and airfields on the mainland. The B-29s made three separate attacks. These superforts have been doing double duty. In addition to aerial bombardment, each bomber is dumping 10 tons of mines into Japan's most important waters in the new Allied plan to block the essentially maritime nation by aerial mines. And in the Okinawa campaign, American troops are advancing to the capital city of Naha in an effort to wipe out the remaining Jap defenses. So far, the Americans now control 3/4 of the island. American planes are operating from two airfields on Okinawa. The Japs themselves have also admitted that the future will be tremendously difficult, to quote a Jap broadcast. But that really is an understatement. And that's the news to this moment from the NBC newsroom in New York. Roger Bowman speaking. This is the National Broadcasting Company.